media in several programs. We also started to talk about in one of the programs the seerah and the sunnah, the manners and the conducts and the behaviors and even the statements and the words of the Holy Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, and of the infallible divinely appointed imams regarding the importance and the significance of the Friday congregational prayers, especially because of the spiritual and even material benefits that this Friday congregational prayer has, and as far as enhancing our ubudiyyah. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he used to free those people who were imprisoned, for example, on account of their debts or some kind of accusation and the like. Why? So that these people could attend the Friday congregational prayers while their guardians used to guarantee that these people would return back to the prison cell after the congregational prayer on Friday was done. And so the Imam Ali alayhi salam, also used to allow the imprisoned transgressors, under guard, of course, to participate in the congregational prayers. Dear friends, how important must the Friday congregational prayers be for our spiritual health, for our even our material worldly health? But here we are focusing on our spiritual health. How important must these prayers be? And what kind of a beautiful connection must there be between the congregational Friday prayers and our ubudiyyah, our servitude of Allah? Such a powerful connection and such powerful blessings that Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, was even freeing certain kinds of prisoners to go and attend the Friday congregational prayers. And then after they finished their Friday congregational prayers, they returned back to the prison. And we are free, yet some of us decide to not go. Let us make sure to try to the best of our ability to attend the Friday congregational prayers when possible in order to level up and fully benefit from the blessings of the Friday congregational prayers as far as our ubudiyyah, our servitude to Allah.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of Foresight coming to you from IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and today I would like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatu Shakirin, The Whispered Prayer of the Thankful. Please stay with me. God, as you have fed us through your gentleness and nurtured us through your benefaction, so also complete for us lavish favors, repel from us detested acts of vengeance and of the shares of the two abodes, give us their most elevated and their greatest, both the immediate and the deferred. To you belongs praise for your good trial and the lavishness of your favors, a praise conforming to your good pleasure and attracting your great goodness and magnanimity. O Almighty, O All Generous, by your mercy, O Most Merciful of the Merciful.
Well, Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. We've been talking about the beautiful outcomes and certain manifestations of the Friday congregational prayers as far as them enhancing our ubudiyah, enhancing our servitude and our obedience to Allah. We talked about in the previous segments how Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, used to even free certain prisoners so that they could attend the Friday congregational prayers and then return back to their imprisonment. This was the importance, and this is the importance, of the Friday congregational prayers. We also talked about how Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was walking towards the congregational prayers, he would do so barefooted without his shoes in order to show his humility in front of Allah. In such a beautiful manner, the Friday congregational prayers increase our ubudiyah, they increase our servitude, our sincerity, and the power of our iman. To the extent where Imam Ali alayhi salam said that this prayer has a special divine status. And finally, we find that Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and the Imam of the Ummah, has said, "The Friday congregational prayers, which is a demonstration of the socio-political power of Islam, must be made more splendid and more substantial. The great and dear nation should keep this Islamic fortress as majestic and as splendid as possible, so that by its blessings, the plots of traitors and the intrigues of corruptors can be thwarted." The beautiful and profound blessings of the Friday congregational prayers as regards to our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Sometimes in my conversation with people, in my talks and what comes in my inbox, and just kind of overhearing some people, I get the sense that, you know, they believe that the deen doesn't have any room for anxiety and stress. Doesn't even accept the fact that a believer should feel anxious and stressed at any time. That at all times there should be a level of serenity, a level of contentment, a level of, you know, this nirvana, this flying, this, you know, just this sense of calmness about them that, you know, no matter what the dunya throws at them, you know, doesn't affect them at all. And if we adopt that incorrect philosophy, if we actually begin to think like that, then any moment of stress or anxiety, we're bound to equate that to the fact that not only am I not handling this properly, but my faith is low as well. Now, I'm repeating myself for the past few nights because I'm just tired of hearing it. Like, it's too much on one person to deal with the heaviness of whatever's making them anxious and stressed out. On top of that, the heaviness of the guilt that I'm just not a good servant of God either. I'm ungrateful. I don't appreciate what He's given me. People have it worse than I do. In the process, you completely just kind of, you know, reject it and downplay every emotion that you feel. I have no right to feel this way. There are people who are far worse off than me. And the further you push it down, the more it comes back even more ferocious the very next time. These are things that we need to really truly understand. I want to further visit this notion that a true believer is one who should never be anxious and stressed out. I kind of feel that's a very old school mentality. Our older generations just say, don't worry about it. You know, they're very carefree, right? Borderline careless almost sometimes, but definitely carefree. Not to the sense that they didn't care, but, you know, they were perhaps a little bit stronger because they saw more, right? They dealt with more. They saw poverty, let's say, for example. They saw, you know, tragedy. They saw hardships at a very deep level. Not that we don't, but, you know, sometimes, you know, it's a different ball game when we talk about the generation before us. Anyways, this idea that this world, this dunya that we live in, this alam in nasut, alam in nifal, the lowest, asfal asaf, however you want to describe this world that we live in, it is a temporary world, one that will perish. Kullu man alayha fan, everything will perish, including this dunya. It's a temporary abode. It's not made to be attached to. One of the purposes beside this dunya, because all of behind this dunya, and all of us know, we understand that our creation was made at the level of a very azim and a very great creation. We know enough to know that Allah gave us a body and gave us a soul, and that soul, wa nafakhtu fihi min ruhi, is part of His soul, meaning part of Allah's soul, part of His ruh, His spirit, whatever that means. And this azamat had caused Him to say, faqa'u lahu sajideen. All of you now bow down to this azam. Okay? Then He decides Allah to put Him on this earth. Right? In fact, that was always the plan from day number one. Sometimes this notion that right now we, human beings, are paying for the mistake of Adam in the heavens is an incorrect notion inside of the Islamic teachings. Adam was always made for the earth. Even before the creation of Adam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala described to the angels in Surah Baqarah, إِنِّي جَعَلُمْ فِي الْأَرْضٍ خَلِيفًا فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفًا. On this earth, I'm going to make a khalifa. So Adam, even before creation, he already had his mission laid out for him. It's not like all of a sudden because he went towards that tree, that forbidden tree, now all of a sudden now the plans have changed and now he's going to be sent down to earth and we're now paying the price for his one mistake. No, not the case at all. That's not what we believe at least.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Now in continuation to what we were saying regarding the beautiful benefits, spiritual benefits and worldly benefits, and as well as the connection that the Friday Congregational Prayers has with our Ubudiyya, we're talking about one more thing, which is in a token of commemorating Friday Congregational Prayers and glorifying these rites. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, used to attend the congregational prayer barefooted, holding his shoes with his left hand. It is very interesting, but we find such beautiful instances of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him, and the infallible Imams, where they have emphasized the special status and the importance of the Friday congregational prayers. And so we find here that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, this prayer has a special divine status. He was asked, how come you come to these Friday congregational prayers barefooted, without your shoes? And he replied, this prayer has a special divine status. So Imam Ali used to do so out of humility in the presence of Allah. What a beautiful manifestation, what a beautiful signal of how the Friday congregational prayers can enhance our ubudiyya, how they can truly level up our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah. When we find that the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, is saying that it has a special divine status, and he used to attend these prayers without his shoes. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
2016's presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Election and political participation is a way to choose an official or officials for a specific post. Election is the symbol of people's rule over their own fate. However, elections in some countries are quiet, ceremonial, and a mere show of democracy. In Iraq, there are two kinds of elections. One is the election of city councils. Each province in Iraq is considered as a domain and enjoys its specific administrative establishment and provincial council. The other election is the parliamentary election. The president is also elected by the parliament. The president should be a Sunni Kurd. The parliament speaker should be a Sunni Arab, and the prime minister should be a Shia. In Syria, the president is elected for 7 years. Parliamentary and city council elections are other elections that are held in this country. In Kuwait, there are elections for city councils and parliament. The parliamentary election functions stronger in this country in comparison with other Arab countries in the region. Saudi Arabia is the only country which has not experienced any election so far. The monarchic regime has never allowed the people to go to ballot boxes to elect their desired officials. The United Arab Emirates has a parliamentary election every 4 years, which is totally ceremonial, as the parliament has no power before the royal family. Bahrain is just like the UAE. Yusuf Al-Huri, Bahraini political activist, says on democracy in the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region, "The fact is that the systems of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region have not come to power on the basis of election. The ruling systems in these countries have rather come to power by colonialist systems like Britain, and they are supported by this country so that they may be able to continue their rule and exchange interests with each other. Today, we know it well that it is the British who caused Al Khalifa to rule in Bahrain and have supported them so far," unquote. Dear listeners, the same is true with Saudi Arabia. The system of governance is almost the same in Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar. In Qatar, the only election that is held is related to the city councils. But in Oman, as a royal system, the members of parliament are elected by people. In Lebanon, there are three kinds of election: the presidential election, the parliamentary election, and the city council election are held in this country. The president is chosen by the parliament. In Jordan, there are two legislative houses. The members of the House of Commons and the Senate are appointed by the king, while the representatives of parliament are elected by people. In North Africa, democratic process is more obvious and has a longer record. In Tunisia, for instance, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held. Elections are more seriously pursued in the country after the nationwide uprising and Islamic awakening in 2010. In Morocco, as a royal system, there are two elections for the House of Representatives and the House of Advisors. In Algeria, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held, while in Sudan only the presidential election is held. In each of the mentioned countries, various elections are held, but participation is very limited in many of them. That's why free and fair election has always been one of the serious demands of people.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total of 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans, a military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there. And we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea, countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania, and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables, and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believe if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other water agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiol-D-glycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up, and therefore we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases both in Denmark but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball, laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
Muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonius has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rakic have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally, because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement, because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands. has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia.
Wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran. But when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it.
Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and an act for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. The Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and the Pris will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting Pris will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multi-purpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the space station assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yisa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yisa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild.
IRIB English Radio.